Hello, and thank you for listening to WFIU. I'm Christina Kuzmich, and here in our studio is a very special guest, composer Don Freund. Don is a professor of composition at the Indiana University School of Music here in Bloomington. He received his bachelor's degree in composition and piano performance from Duquesne University, and he attended the Eastman School of Music for his master's and for his doctorate degrees. You can hear his music in concerts and recitals at the music school, and also during the next hour, we'll be playing some of his compositions and talking to him about his music. Don, welcome to WFIU.
Thank you, Christina.
I'm going to start off with something that you once said in one of your lectures. A composer is a searcher. What are you searching for?
Searching for ideas that will implant themselves into our general cultural consciousness and individual listeners. Something that'll give us a better realization of what's wonderful about life, make us want to answer some of the troubling things that are always facing us. And I'm searching for ways of doing things that are unique and never been done before and still not alien to the general listener, which is hard to find these days.
Something else you once said was that a composer has to get into the head of the listener. How do you get inside the head of a listener?
Well, I think what I love about music is that, unlike any other art form, I think it doesn't exist anywhere else except inside listeners' consciousness. You really have to remember what you've just heard to enjoy a piece of music. And to really get to love something, it almost has to be a part of you. You have to walk around singing the tunes. You've got to recognize things when they come back. So that it requires amount of imagination and amount of memory, amount of physical internalization of the ideas for a listener to enjoy a piece of music. I don't think there's any other art form that demands so much individual stake from the observer in that art form. And because of that, I think music becomes a part of us like no other art form really can be. And it's so mysterious the way it happens, but it's a wonderful thing. And I think too much time we think about how music is produced or how it gets across the airwaves or how a performer's finger makes a certain kind of sound. And what's really important to me is what happens inside the listener's head when they're listening to that piece.
Can you think of one piece that you would like us to hear right now?
Yeah, well, actually, a good kickoff piece is this work, an orchestral piece called Radical Light. And this is a piece that's built on a poem by a poet, A.R. Ammons, which is just about this kind of idea. There's a lot of pieces have been written lately about fast rides in infernal machines and this kind of wild, spacey craziness, which I really like, but at the same time, it seems a little alien to me. And what I wanted to do was find an idea that talked more about how this wonderful, magical wildness can be something that's inside of us. And this poem by Ammons, I'll read just a few lines out of it. It's called He Held Radical Light. And the poem goes, He held radical light as music in his skull. Music turned as over ridges, eminences of evening light rise. Turned back over the furrows of his brain into the dark, shuddered, shot out again in long, swaying swirls of sound. There's a lot of imagery in there, but what's great about that imagery is it's all a human being having thoughts and ideas, which is what excites me most about creative life.
We're going to hear Radical Light for a large orchestra, composed in 1989, and here in the performance that was done in 1992 by the Indiana University Concert Orchestra, conducted by Thomas Baldner.
Thank you.
That was Radical Light, a composition for large orchestra by composer Don Freund. And it was performed here by the Indiana University Concert Orchestra under the direction of Thomas Baldner, a 1992 recording. This is WFIU Bloomington. We are talking to Don Freund, professor of composition at the IU School of Music. I have a follow-up question for this piece. It's very tightly constructed. It sounds to me like a piece that an orchestra could put together easily with just a few rehearsals. Do you keep that in mind when you write for large ensembles?
I keep it in mind. It always doesn't work out the way I plan it. There's a lot of little difficulties in that piece that I guess you have to anticipate, and changing meters, and actually it's so exposed. Sometimes the easiest sounding things are the hardest things to do. So, but it is something I'm very conscious of. I think what we learn most of all as in our lives as composers is how to deal with real performance situations. And how performers will respond to our musical ideas and our notations of them. And the problem of how to notate something so it'll get right to the heart of what the performer wants to do and will understand how to do it is the big challenge, I think, in composition.
How much leeway do you give your performers?
Well, a lot. In an orchestral piece, you can't give them very much at all because you know orchestras aren't going to have very much time to rehearse. They hardly ever really have a chance to identify with a piece. And although people tend to identify composers by their orchestral music, that's probably the least personal kind of expression a composer can have these days. Because when you're writing for orchestra, you know that they're going to be doing it kind of superficially. It's just, it just goes along with the turf. When you're writing chamber music, you have a lot more leeway, and you, especially if you know you have time to work with the performers and let your ideas sort of sift into their consciousness, let them come back with ideas about how they want to do your ideas. And that's the ultimate joy for a composer, is to find out that the performers not only can do what you want them to do, but can go beyond that, can take your ideas and run with them. So it, I think the notation has to be very clear to the point where it gives the performer an idea of how the idea goes to begin with. And that takes a lot of clarity, a lot of detail in the notation. But then that performer, once they've absorbed those details, then they have to run with it. Then they have to forget about all those details and take the ideas as they've learned it and make their own musical communication out of it.
Let's talk a little bit about what affects a composer. We all hear so much non-classical music in all of our environments. Does that enter into your music?
Yeah, I guess I'd be pretty much on the left wing of what composers are willing to allow themselves to be influenced by these days. I'll just take anything. I love a lot of pop music. I spent 20 years teaching in Memphis, which is a mecca for pop music, the way that Bloomington is a mecca for classical music and opera. And I think all of us, it's funny, we're beginning now to realize as art music composers that we have to find ways to include the feelings and the loving things that we got from the rock and roll we grew up with as kids and the blues we hear in different places and world music, which is spreading all around us these days. It's a great time to be alive. And for a while, I think classical composers were very concerned about somehow being compromised by so many different things in their lives. And I think now we've decided this is our lives. And if we don't express it in our music, we're denying ourselves a large part of our humanity.
So you feel that that's a trend amongst many 20th century composers now to amalgamate all types of styles into their composition?
Very definitely. Yeah, you see every year it seems like there's more and more composers who are very sort of tight about what they would allow their music to sound like and express, sort of jumping over the edge and getting more into popsy sounding things. Sometimes it's an embarrassment because they don't. It's a very difficult thing to do. It's one thing to say composers ought to be writing music more like what people like to listen to, but to combine all this with our traditions of Western art music, with the kind of compositional qualities we're trying to express in our music, and put all these things together, it takes a lot of doing. I've been doing it for years and years and years, so I feel like I'm beginning to understand how it can be done without somehow transcending certain kinds of aesthetic qualities that I think art music has to have.
Which is the perfect segue into our next selection. This is Backyard Songs, and Don, tell us a little bit about this piece.
Well, this was commissioned by a group in New York called the Jubal Trio, a flute, harp, and soprano, classical soprano who sings Milton Babbitt and all the very uptown kind of New York things. And I wanted to write something that was different from anything they would else program on their programs. And at that time, I had also just come from some great blues concerts in Memphis and had been listening to a lot of Ella Fitzgerald. So I thought, well, why not try to see if I can somehow capture in a piece for harp and flute and voice, which is hardly what your standard blues group sounds like, some of the qualities of Ella and Ruby Wilson and great blues singers as well as great pop singers. And I found some great poetry. It's the biggest difficulty in writing songs is finding poetry which somehow is lyrical, which can be set as a song, which is clear and straightforward and yet not talking down. And I found this in the poetry of Gwendolyn Brooks, a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet from Chicago, expressing the black experience in a way that I sort of stole as a white person. Sometimes I feel a little guilty about incorporating other people's experience, but I've stopped. I've gotten over that. I think we're all just one people now.
Backyard Songs. Marie Mascari is the soprano, Jennifer George, the flutist, and the harpist is Anne Young. You just heard a portion of Backyard Songs, three poems by Gwendolyn Brooks, performed here by soprano Marie Mascari, flutist Jennifer George, and harpist Ann Young. Music of Don Freund, and we're talking to Don Freund today, professor of composition at the Indiana University School of Music, Bloomington campus. You mentioned something before we started to play this piece, that you've lost your innocence as far as stealing from other cultures and other musics is concerned, and you no longer have any guilt feelings about that. What has been your personal experience with other musics and other cultures? Is it something that you actually studied in an academic setting or something that you experienced in your personal life?
Oh, I think it's almost always the latter. I have very little academic background in jazz and pop music. I just lived through a lot of it. And learning music from other cultures is always a learning experience. And it's great at my age, which is getting about, I have to say, middle these days.
That's the safe place to be.
Yeah, right. to be able to find really fresh, just world-changing experiences. And where I get most of that is hearing music from other cultures, because this is music that's not fabricated in any way. It comes straight out of someone's heart and straight out of the same sort of ears and tuning senses and reactions to musical sound that we all have. And yet they're reacting in a way that is very individual, very different. And yet once you listen to a little of it, you get your own sense of it. And to hear that experience and to recognize what's going on, it's an inspiration to me to try to capture some of that feeling in my music.
I'd like to touch more on the issue of the world we live in and how our environment affects us as artists. The fact that Don Freund is composing in 1997 and not 1897 or 1797, how do you think that affects your music?
Well, of course, it affects in the obvious ways that we're hearing a lot of kinds of music people didn't hear 100, 200 years ago. Not only music from the world of our present time, but also early music, something that's a wonderful treasure here in Bloomington, something I've always loved and used a lot of. So I like to use Gothic music, music from the Middle Ages. I like to use traces of earlier classical music. But I think what's most different about our lives from the lives of earlier composers and artists is not only do we have all this material to confront us, but we're also faced of some manner of putting it together. We have to make some sense out of our lives, and where our ways of dealing with these juxtapositions and confrontations make us, I think, different kind of artists, different kind of people. When you scan a radio dial or when you go cable cruising or when you watch Sesame Street, you're confronted with an entirely different experience almost every 30 seconds. And we've sort of accepted that as part of our life. And I think it makes us different thinkers. Some people would think it's kind of cheap. It makes us sort of soundbite oriented, and we no longer can sit and listen to long pieces with the same sort of depth and emotional maturity. Personally, I don't think that's necessarily true. I think we have a fantastic adroitness in the way we listen and think today that other cultures, previous cultures, never had the opportunity to develop. And that's what I like about what we can do with music today. We can stop on a dime and turn around and jump 20 centuries in a single bound. And it makes me feel very excited and powerful and delighted with the situation we find today.
Well, I guess that's the end of long development sections in symphonies. Here's a futuristic question that I know that many composers don't particularly like to answer. So you need your crystal ball for it. Where are we going to be in the 21st century as far as classical art music is concerned?
Well, I just came from a composer's conference where the moderator of the panel was predicting that people would not be performing music, that everything would be absorbed from the web. It's almost an alien age where everybody's sitting by themselves in front of their computer and there's no more communication, and that the whole idea of performing something on an instrument will be totally passé. I don't see anything to support that view of the future. I find more and more people today interested in just sitting down and making acoustic sounds, either with their voice or with an acoustic instrument, or even if it's an electronic instrument, trying to make it perform in some sort of very sensitive, natural way to our natural impulses, the way we move our fingers, the way we breathe, the way we look at the world, expressed through our own performance. So I really believe that performing is going to become just as important, if not more important, a way for music to get into people's lives. Sure, we're listening to a lot of it on CDs or through some sort of electronic medium, but still what at the heart of it all is the idea that there's a person producing the sound, and hopefully a composer who also has that kind of humanity writing the music. And although I'm sure it will be packaged in many, many different kinds of ways, I think that the arts will merge to a certain extent, and we have to be willing to look at our music in various kinds of formats. still at the heart of it all will be, it still has to be something that a player can play, a listener can feel empathy with someone performing it and with someone composing it. And that empathy, I think, is at the heart of all art, and I can't see it ever leaving.
So technology may yet lead us around full circle to the human contact and to ensemble playing. And
I hope so. Technology has forced a lot of sort of mechanism upon us, and drum machines and music written by computers is something we've all had a taste of. And I think I'm not running scared from that anymore, because I don't think it's working. People can recognize that there's not that human thought and feeling behind it. So I think humanity is finally sort of weathered the first storm, at least, in the technology crisis. And now it's important to make the technology which fit our humanity like a glove, rather than trying to make ourselves fit into some sort of preordained vision of what technology will bring us.
Let's get to some more music. Tell me about Pentecost.
Oh, okay. Pentecost is one of my favorite pieces. It's good for just illustrating some of the things I've just been talking about. One is it's built on obsession with medieval music. None of the stuff that you hear that sounds like Machaut or Gothic music is actually stolen. It's newly composed music that just happens to sound a lot like that. But it's a time of kind of quality of music that I've always been entranced by. So you hear a lot of that, but you also hear a lot of more contemporary sounds challenging it, and the sense of music being broken up and finally coming back together to create a whole new object is what the piece is about. You'll hear a lot of Latin in the singing. It's got a singer and a small ensemble performing in it. I didn't really intend for anybody to understand the Latin. It becomes almost sort of a mantra or a magical evoking of calling the spirit together, and how the spirit can take rather dull, ordinary human beings and turn them into brilliant creators. And that's what the piece is about.
Coming up, we have Pentecost, a composition by Don Freund. It's for soprano and small ensemble. It's performed here by the Indiana University New Music Ensemble, and Julia Hunt is the soprano. Thank you. You've just heard a portion of a piece called Pentecost for soprano and small ensemble, performed here by the Indiana University New Music Ensemble, and Julia Hunt was the soprano. Don, do you find that performers prefer pieces that are based on traditional music?
Yeah, I think they do. Sometimes it's not the best thing to say about them because I think performers are naturally conservative, and I think we have to fight that a little bit. But what I try to do is give them a little bit of what they feel very good doing and then try to push them beyond it into some things they've never tried before. It's interesting to see performers confronting new problems, and if you can couch it in some sort of terms that they understand, will make them look good, will make them sound good. They're happy with that. But I think we have to be very careful to make sure that as composers, we're not trying to simply be makeup artists for performers. We have our own ideas and our own visions of what music needs to do. And performers, I think really good performers know that and do it. And the ones who don't do it really need to be taught that. And I think we're having more and more performers realizing these days that you can't contribute much to society simply by playing the same old music the same old way all the time. And the really great artists today are looking for composers to challenge them, to find new ways of looking at the world that they've never done before.
This is WFAU Bloomington, and we're talking to composer Don Freund, who is a professor of composition at the Indiana University School of Music in Bloomington. This brings us to our next piece, Ukrainian Fantasy. That was actually commissioned by a violinist, and it incorporates not only new music composed for him, but it's also based on Ukrainian folk tunes. How did that come about?
Well, it didn't come about because I was a great fan of Ukrainian folk music. I knew absolutely nothing about it when the violinist Adrian Bertin came to me and said he wanted a piece like Ravel's Tsigan. And what he had imagined, being a performer, who, although he was Ukrainian and loved all this folk music, he wanted something that sounded pretty much like your flashy, romantic, virtuoso violin piece with a piano accompaniment. But I said I wanted to hear some music. And this is one of these great experiences when you are confronted with music you've never heard before, and your first reaction is, oh my God, I can't, this doesn't do anything for me at all. It's not me. I don't even like it. But then as I started listening to music, I just fell in love with it. But I fell in love with it realizing that what I loved was the sound of the instruments and the quality that I could never see myself capturing in a piece for piano and violin. So the great leap I made was to decide to take all these folk recordings that Adrian had given me and turn them into a tape collage, which is then heard along with the violin and makes a piece, I think, an interesting kind of experience of a modern violinist here in America playing a sort of a virtuoso violin piece, but still being very much surrounded and captivated by the roots of his folk music.
Here's the last 4 minutes of the Ukrainian Fantasy, a composition for violin and collage tape. In this particular performance, Mark Menzies is the violinist, and the tape is, well, performed by the tape. Thank you. composition for violin and collage tape performed here by violinist Mark Menzies, and a composition by Don Freund, who is here in our studios today. Don Freund is a composer, and he's also a professor of composition at the Indiana University School of Music in Bloomington. Don, you have a special fondness for Bach. Why Bach?
Well, I guess it appeals to so many different kinds of parts of my personality. One is, as a pianist, it's such an absorbing experience to perform this music. It demands so much concentration from your ears and your harmonic sense and your melodic sense and rhythmic sense. And it's also something I've always loved choral music, because I grew up singing in choirs. And the vocal music of Bach is certainly the greatest ever written. But I think more than anything else, as I've been performing a lot of Bach and memorizing, I like to memorize the Preludes and Fugues, other Wohltemper Klavier, as sort of a musical discipline. I find that the greatest thing about it is the compositional freshness. There's nothing that's set in stone about Bach. There's no form that is repeated. Every piece has its own sort of logic, its own sort of creative whimsy and power. And there's so much in this music that holds your imagination. It's definitely Desider Island stuff. You could spend the rest of your life doing nothing but Bach, and you'd be a better person for it, probably.
That's true. It seems that every composer through history had to study Bach.
Mm-hmm.
So he was sort of the great common denominator amongst composers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. It's a miracle. I don't know how it ever happened, but I'm sure happy to be here to have it.
One of your pieces, Departing Flights for Piano Trio, actually has a section that is based on a Bach selection or a Bach piece. You want to tell us about that?
Well, one thing I like to do is to take a title, a word maybe, and work out various manifestations, various meanings, connotations it can have for me. And when I was in an airport and saw the word Departing Flights, I thought that'd be a great name for a piece. And I started thinking about all sorts of flights and departures that one can do in a piece of music. And one of the first pieces I ever learned by Bach was a rather slight piece called Capriccio on the Departure of a Beloved Brother, which was about Bach's brother going off and on a journey, and this music was written to represent the grieving of his family as he left and those kind of things. And of course, one of the connotations of departing, of the departed, is the dead. And although there's a lot of joy and fast, exciting music in my output as a composer, I like to concentrate on that. There's also this always tinged by the awareness of our mortality. And having had a brother who died at a very early age, I wanted to write something for him. And the combination of events, thinking, writing this piece about departures, writing a piece about departing flights, just all seemed to come together. And so this does have quotes from that Bach Capriccio wound into very emotional and sometimes very sweet, but I hope contemporary sounding music against the framework of this rather polite but still very deeply felt Baroque music.
But in this particular composition, one movement is based on music by Bach, but there's another one that's based on music by Isaac.
Yes, well, I started writing this piece when I was leaving Memphis to come to Bloomington, and another famous composer, Renaissance composer, Hendrik Isaac, wrote a piece to commemorate his leaving Innsbruck. And again, it's my love for early music, for Renaissance music. This tune had been in my mind for a long time. And so the first part of this movement, which is called Alternate Extensions, deals with very kind of bluesy rock and roll tunes that get extended in various different ways. It's a question of how does one make your way through life? Where do you travel? How do you go? What direction do you come back home, or do you make an exit and never come back again? And so that the whole movement, really the large body of the music, is about this. And at the very, very end of the piece comes this beautiful little Renaissance lead by Isaac leaving Innsbruck. Of course, I was thinking about leaving Memphis at the time, so you can change the words around. But I think it's a common human experience that we all share. And I think what I want to do in my music is to find these experiences and find different ways of comparing them and looking at them, juxtaposing them. And that's what that movement's about.
Now, we won't have time to actually hear the entire movements for both of these, but I'd like for us to hear the Bach, and that will be followed by the Isaac. So here's Departing Flights for Piano Trio. It's performed here by Vivian Kim, violinist, Paula Kosover, cello, and Molly Murkowski is the pianist. The first piece we'll hear is a portion on the departure of a beloved brother. That was On the Departure of a Beloved Brother, the last 3 or 4 minutes of it. And coming up next, we have the ending of Alternate Extensions, which is based on the music of Heinrich Itzhak. That was a portion of Alternate Extensions from a composition called Departing Flight for piano trio, and it was performed here by members of the IU New Music Ensemble. We're talking to Don Freund, professor of composition at the Indiana University School of Music in Bloomington. Don, you recently composed a ballet for the IU Ballet Department based on Flaubert's Madame Bovary. And in this case, you had to incorporate dance and a storyline. So that was a little different.
Yeah, and wonderful experience. Very different from anything I've done before, because this is almost like writing movie music to a certain extent. You've got a real storyline, you've got the support, and you have to support real emotions and plot developments, and also be dealing with dance and dancing and choreography. And I had the wonderful experience of working with Jacques Cesbron on this. It's actually Jacques' idea to do Madame Bovary as a ballet, and a lot of his friends, and the first I even said, well, I don't know if this can possibly work, but he was able to envision a way that it would work as a ballet, and told me the choreographic scenario, and then I went to work writing music to fit that scenario.
So tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear as far as the plot is concerned.
Well, this is the very end of the ballet. This is where Emma finally has all the forces of nature turning against her. Her lovers that she thought were going to bring her romantic excitement in her life have sort of turned their back on her. She's run up a lot of debts that she's now no longer able to borrow against, and her house is being, all the furniture is being sold. Her husband, Charles, is still deeply in love with her, but she somehow feels that she's betrayed him and her lovers have betrayed her, and life has just gone totally black for her. So what we hear is the end of this feeling of desperation that finally leads to her running to the apothecary shop, finding some arsenic and stuffing it out of her hand, and then the throes of death that are follow this. And turning this into a dance seemed like a difficult thing to do, but Jacques' ballet, his choreography of bringing Charles and Emma together at the end as she writhes in pain but still expresses this beautiful lyricism of her life and her dreams, all comes together for this beautifully tragic ending.
Here is the ending section of the concert suite from the ballet Madame Bovary, and it's performed here by the Indiana University Concert Orchestra, conducted by Don Freund. You've just heard the last two movements from the concert suite from the ballet Madame Bovary, Desperation and Throes of Death. And it was performed here by the Indiana University Concert Orchestra, conducted by our guest composer, Don Freund. Don, how important is it for a composer to experience other art forms like dance and sculpture and literature?
I think it's tremendously important. We need to get out of a blinder's view of our art, and spend a lot of my time when I'm trying to imagine pieces, imagining the work, especially if you have friends in other art forms that you can communicate with and find out how they do their work. I've written a lot of pieces built around painting, which is something I don't think, well, of course we have a famous example of Mussorgsky, but paintings don't really inspire as much music as I think they might. There's so much you can find. Of course, drama and working with dance is something I've done all my life, and every time I turn to it, it changes a lot of things about your perspective of time. It's interesting, too, that people in the other arts have a very different way of working, a way of rehearsing, a way of learning their pieces. Working with actors, for example, is entirely different from working with performers. They spend an enormous amount of time really getting things down and internalized. And from that experience, you learn how time and expression can work in various forms that deal with time as an element.
I want to ask you a more general question as far as the composer's role is concerned as advocate of music and music education. We always hear horror stories about the demise of the arts in our public schools and in our society in general. What can the composer do in a very tangible fashion to help advocate the arts and music in particular?
Well, I think it's very important for composers to be out in society, for people to meet them, and especially for young people to meet them. I think that our future, of course, lies with our youth. And it's really important in education for young people to realize that music is not just some sort of art form that's handed down forever and ever, but it's something that people are actively involved in creating and that they can actively create. I have a theory that people wouldn't like to watch basketball if they hadn't shot a few hoops sometime in their life. And I don't think people would enjoy listening to music with anywhere the kind of vitality they should have if they haven't done a little composing on their own. A lot of people suggest that composition can't be taught. I'm totally opposed to that vision. I think there's an awful lot that we can do to get people realizing how much there is that can be done and can be thought about in structuring sound. And you don't have to be a tremendous virtuoso to be able to do that kind of thing. We're finding that students in elementary school can do a lot of improvisation and creation of musical ideas. And somewhere along the line, they start feeling they can do that. I think somewhere around junior high school, people start losing their sense of what can be done with their own musical creativity, and it's hard to reconstruct that after they've gone through that period. So I think what's needed more than anything else is for composers to teach other people to teach composition, that we can all get the experience of sharing these ideas and knowing what it's like to imagine what a sound, how a piece can move, how a sound can move in a certain direction or another direction, and that to play around with that. As soon as you start realizing that everything that you hear is some choice that someone made to make the music go a certain direction, I think the excitement comes back into it.
Let's move a little further on to the 17, 18-year-old who's just entering the university or the conservatory. In many cases, these aspiring composers still really haven't found their own voice. And one of the first things that you hear from a composition teacher is that you must respond to what you hear. You must respond to your own voice. How do you know it's your own voice and not the voice of all the composers that you had heard up to the time you were 17?
Yeah, well, I don't think it can be your own voice. I mean, I think everyone's voice is a product of their environment, their time. Perhaps their vision is different, but I don't think it's something that's as easy to hear in two or three measures of music as people would like to believe. I think if you have a concept, a reason for for your wanting to write a piece, something that you want to have happen to people when they listen to it, then eventually your voice will emerge. And I think the best way to acquire that is to study a lot of music, not just what seems to come naturally to you, but to go out and find kinds of music that sound very different from what you're used to listening to, and to discern from all that what it is that means a lot to you, that has a way of expressing ideas that you have always felt. And eventually you grow from that into a composer of personality and distinction.
What's next in store for you?
Well, I'm interested in writing a lot of pieces for the wonderful colleagues I have at IU. One thing I've decided I'm going to spend more time doing in the next couple of years is generating pieces for the fabulous performers that are around. Things I hope also to be continuing to work with the ballet and drama departments. Also probably look for some new experiences in other media. You never can predict these things, but throughout my life has always been some gadget that comes by and you look at it and say, well, nobody's made music for this yet, but I think it's possible.
Don, it's been a pleasure to have you with us and share some of your music with our listeners. I've been talking to Don Freund, composer and professor of composition at the IU School of Music, Bloomington campus, for WFIU. I'm Christina Kuzmich.